Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to bicker about in the interim. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. at 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322, or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly or inhumanly possible on the station archives. My own blog appears at howtheneoconstolefreedom.blogspot.com. And this week it is entitled Nicks on Bush and calls for all right-minded Republicans to retake their party and excise Bush and company. The idle thought that brought the article and the accompanying graphic into existence was a sad reflection that compared to Bush, Nixon looks good to me, something I would never have believed possible. When Richard Nixon seems kindly, sweet, and honorable, there is a problem even bigger than a war in the Middle East. Someone who can use the rhetoric of freedom to justify torture and the cancellation of the Constitution is ugly where it does not show, not just ugly where you can see. Today, Americans need a president we can all trust. Fortunately, there's someone like that out there. Congressman Ron Paul has taken out papers for an exploratory committee. Paul is one of the very few Congress people who stood up and voted no on the war in Iraq, no on the Patriot Act, and on other continuing atrocities that are converting Americans into serfs. Drop by the blog. I hope you enjoy the read. And now some updates from the week just passed. Mrs. Blankenship, the elderly lady from Dallas whose votes were stolen on a Diebold machine, has continued to press for justice. She vows she will not stop, and we believe her. But to date, she has heard nothing. The commissioners had 65 days to respond to her Freedom of Information Act. Nothing happened. She has written to the Elections Committee in Collin County and to the three reps who created the Havel Law and sent a letter to the Attorney General. She's listed the names of the people she voted for. She's given them an exact reproduction of her ballot. But the silence continues to be deafening. Mrs. Blankenship, who is an alumnus of SMU, also reports that the Bush takeover of SMU is causing strident and serious opposition. Methodist ministers have launched a petition to stop the Bush library at SMU. They say it's inappropriate. And in Associated Press just today, there was an article on the subject. Quote, a group of Methodist ministers from across the nation launched an online petition drive Thursday, urging Southern Methodist University to stop trying to land George W. Bush's presidential library. The petition on a new website, protectsmu.org, says that, quote, as Methodist ministers, we believe that the linking of his presidency with the university bearing the Methodist name is utterly inappropriate, unquote. Methodists have a long history of social conscience, so questions about the conduct of this president are very concerning, said one of the petition's organizers, the Reverend Andrew J. Weaver of New York, who graduated from SMU's Perkins School of Theology. Mrs. Blankenship went on to mention that local Methodists who do not want the Bush Library anywhere near them because of Bush's use of torture, not including Karl Rove, have decided that they're going to take further action. So stay tuned, because there will be more developments. Now, if you have been following the Howie Rich Initiative, the Boondoggles, you may have noticed that Hart Williams is again back in the saddle. The last chapter featured Hart and others responding to Howie and friends. This chapter will focus on a full frontal assault on the gang from New York. Follow the action at hartwilliams.com as state after state takes up legislation to ensure that the people know where the money came from. Thanks to all the listeners who commented on the Jimmy stories I shared last week. It was my very real pleasure to share my memories of James Dean. And now our thought for the week ahead. Last week we heard from David Owens, the plucky mayor from London Britain Township in Landenburg, Pennsylvania, a small town in Pennsylvania who reported that he has handled all the little problems and is now working on confronting unfunded mandates, the problem that comes glumping onto the scene via government. Unfunded mandates are one of the means government uses to force local communities to pay for big-ticket items they neither want nor need. David and other mayors and activists are now coming together to plan action for taking the control back local, and will be holding a conference this summer in Ohio. So stay tuned. We'll be hearing about that. People all over America are working to make their communities better places to raise children. Working on the local level makes everything look different to you. When you've poured your own sweat into creating a solution to a problem, you become invested. You also have extended yourself into the community, building something that may well last long after you're dead. When the focus stays local, we're really changing the world and not just shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic. Our guest today spent a lifetime in the world of business, but he had started life in the small California town of Monrovia. When he returned there to retire, he discovered the music programs, so fondly remembered from his own childhood, had been defunded by the state. A man of action, Mr. Stoller started an organization that today ensures that the music does not stop for children in Monrovia. Please welcome Bruce Stoller. Bruce, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. My pleasure.
Yeah, and we always start by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves. And I haven't told our audience much about you, so why don't you tell us a little about Bruce Stoller?
Well, I came to Monrovia in 1940 at about 3 years old, lived through World War II and the Korean War here. We graduated from high school here in 1954. Attended various colleges and universities, and finished up at UC Santa Barbara. I'm married. Between my wife and I, we have 8 children, 16 grandchildren, and a brand new great-grandchild.
Wow, a full house.
Indeed. You're never wanting for a place to go. And that's always nice. That's always very, very nice. I retired as an investment manager. I've been in the securities business since 1969, and was involved through my company in underwriting all manner of companies, that is, raising both new funds and additional funds for them, and then had a clientele of individuals that I took care of their investment needs. And I still look at Apple Computer as an example. Here's two guys that had a great idea, and look how it's flown since that time. And we were privileged to take them public, I believe, in 1981.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite an accomplishment.
Well, it's not my accomplishment. I was just a small piece of it that was done nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
But still proud to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. And so you were raised in Monrovia.
Yes. We were raised, I think, differently than children are now, in that we had the run of the town. from a very early age. I can remember my mother sending me down with labels before I could read, probably maybe 4 years old or so, a little money, and go around to the store around the corner and bring me one of each, and boy, you better bring me the change. And, you know, you're out there alone, and nobody's bothering you. You're not worried about predators or whatever. The thought did not even occur then.
Mm-hmm. It was a very different world back then.
It was, even with the war hanging over you, it was slower paced, and kids had, I think, more time to actually think about things and reflect, and also to play among themselves. Just using their imaginations. We had very little in the way of toys available. The materials were part of the war effort, and you use your imagination and perhaps sticks and whatever to serve as weapons to play war or whatever. We did a lot of that.
You can do a lot with a cardboard box.
You can do immense things with a cardboard box.
I seem to remember that a cardboard box could become a tank very easily.
Cardboard boxes could, if they were available then. They actually weren't. Most of the materials that we had were shared among probably four different sets of neighborhood children, and just not much, mostly things of wood. Plastics were not available for toys then, if they were in fact available, and certainly nothing metal. I can remember having a scooter, and you look at all these really neat scooters that kids have now, all metal and very sleek. This thing was made of wood and was the clumsiest looking thing you've ever seen. And if you can imagine rolling down a street on a turned wooden wheel on a wooden axle, well, you got the idea.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was the times. But you know, we had a library here in town. You could get yourself a card at a very young age and take out books, and you could still walk to school without your parents having to take you or even walk with you. It was a different time.
Mm-hmm.
I look at all the children have to learn now, or perhaps I should say study and learn to be tested on. And we didn't have those kind of pressures really in school. And not that people didn't develop their talents, because they did. I can't tell you how many professional people that I graduated with, and how many good business people and just general good workmen. And but it was from a different kind of schooling, a lot of emphasis on working with your hands and your head, as opposed to just sit on your butt and listen to the teacher and then regurgitate it back.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, that's better in terms of integrating cognitively.
Yep.
Because there are many different ways to learn, and if a child is denied any access to learning in a way that's good for them, then they really don't learn, and we're seeing that in our educational system.
Oh, I think we're seeing it quite a bit. I do some volunteer work at a continuation high school and see the students that have to go there, and it's their last chance to finish high school. They've been kicked out of the local high school, and they either make or break it there. And so many of them are discipline problems.
Mm-hmm.
They just haven't learned to value learning. And interestingly, they had one program going for a couple of years, and then lost the teacher. It was an art program, and to see these the work that these students did, and I had no way of knowing what previous instruction they had, but to see the work that they were capable of doing was just great. And of course, it decorated the halls of the school, and there's a little more more pride, and I think a little more interest in school during that period of time.
Mm-hmm. See, it isn't that children are really different at all. It's that what we're doing in terms of training them has changed, and it hasn't been a change for the good.
Well, I don't. I agree with you there. Just an example, the music program that you mentioned, why the state in its infinite wisdom decided that it would stop funding instrumental music instruction at the elementary school level. Well, okay, if you're going to have a band in your high school and a band in your junior high school, where do the musicians come from? Of course, some of the children's parents can afford to send them for private instruction, but the bulk of the children were getting their instructions within the district, mm-hmm. and suddenly that's at an end. So you have to keep it going. And then Bush, as part of his No Child Left Behind, mandated that instructors should be fully certified teachers at school, so you couldn't have good musicians teaching music unless they were certified.
Which, of course, drives up the cost.
Well, it either drives up the cost or it drives it off campus. And in
yes.
this case, it's driven it off campus.
So that's horrific, too.
It is, and yet, it goes on. There is instruction, and the teachers that are doing it are dedicated, and the district is dedicated to doing it.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you're finding is that everybody is dedicated to making sure the kids get what they need, and where you're being tripped up is in mandates, regulations.
I think what you're
told has to happen.
Yes, I think that's pretty well it. The teachers are certainly dedicated and want to teach, but unfortunately it can't always be so. Just as an example, this high school here has always had about 2,000 students, give or take, and was able to have a full marching band and a concert band and an orchestra and a junior orchestra and probably 7 different vocal groups, some of them numbering maybe 50, 60 students. Now it's just restarting, and the vocal groups probably total 20, and the band perhaps 100. And so far as I know, there's no real orchestra. It's just forming. So there was a loss there for quite some time.
And those, of course, are kids. They're never going to catch up with that. That'll be something that's simply absent in their lives.
No, they're going to have to do it. Do it on their own. And going back to your comment about cognition and burning, why? One of the things that we've been doing is encouraging people our own age to go back to school and, like at a junior college or whatever, and take a music class, a keyboard class, or something like that, to keep the old brain working.
Right, and of course that's a good thing. But continuing education is different than when you actually have all those skill sets there when you're young. I mean, it increases your pleasure in music, too.
Definitely.
There's so many ways in which it enlarges the scope of your life.
Well, my wife played piano younger and gave up some of it, certainly, to raise her family. And she went back last year and took an intermediate keyboard class. And we have a piano at home, and suddenly the piano is being played again
mm-hmm.
because rusty skills have... I've been honed a bit, and just from this one class. And she plans on going back again.
Mm-hmm. So, when you went back to Monrovia and confronted the fact that the kids weren't getting what you remembered getting, and you wanted them to have it, what was your reaction to that? When did you realize that the school system had changed?
Well, I think I realized that it had changed somewhat. When my own children were attending school here, we came back in the mid-70s, and my children were either in junior high or high school. And the high schools had not lost quite quite as much as it has since then. And I know my my son in junior high developed as a musician. He learned about three or four instruments and a couple of them well, and he went on to play somewhat professionally. He writes songs and et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it's been probably in the last 20 years that we've seen the need to do something beyond what a PTA might do, or a PTSA as they call it here, and get out and raise money for specific purposes, and perhaps try to influence how that money is to be spent.
Mm-hmm.
So we started the Monrovia Schools Foundation. It'll be 20 years ago this year.
Wow, 20 years.
It's been a quick trip. Been my pleasure. Been on the board since inception, and I serve as its president right now. And we, one of the things that we have done is to go after the alumni, and not unlike what colleges do, to fund scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting some very good responses from some of the older classes, that means that there are probably right now 10 additional scholarships available next year that weren't available 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're building.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And do you find that because of the work you're doing in providing this for the next generation, you involve the alumnus in other ways too, that it sort of brings them together as a more self-conscious community?
Well, it does, and yet it doesn't. There are a lot of people who graduated from this school or from you name it, and they will tell you, high school was the worst 4 years I ever spent in my life, and I don't want to see any of those people again. On the other hand, the majority of the people, though, have fond memories, and some of that majority will step up and provide the energy and the funding to do work like the scholarships, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I think that you have to perhaps have had it, that is, let's say, just a great music program. You have to have had it, even though you may not have participated in it. You have to have had it available to you to know that it should be available to the current crop of students.
Mm-hmm. And so Monrovia did have an excellent program.
Monrovia did, and it still does, except that because of the funding, some of the emphasis has had to shift and stay with the more intellectual endeavors as opposed to the hand-eye, as I choose to call them, endeavors like music and drama and even wood shop, metal shop courses, things like that.
Oh, they don't have as many metal shop courses, though?
No, I don't see much of that at all. In fact, I don't think there's any. They have a good drama program. It's hard to get people out to see these productions, and I will tell you, they're first rate. They've done productions that are far superior to anything I ever saw done when I was in school. And the and yet the attendance, because of, you know, people have so many other things to do with an evening that gee, going to see a high school play or a high school band concert just isn't part of their desire.
Mm-hmm.
Unless perhaps they have children in the school that are going to be performing.
So would it be helpful if there was more of an outreach into the community and more of an involvement that way then?
Well,
because that's certainly the way it used to be.
There is, and certainly the foundation tries to do that. The schools do it too. It's just that, you know, when you've got 131 television channels, why, maybe you just want to stay home rather than go see some teenage kids cavort on a stage or tootle their horn or whatever. And it's really, it's a hard thing to break.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, there's no doubt that television has changed our world.
Well, no doubt about that. We really had no television until I think I was 10, 11 years old. And that's when KTLA was, Channel 5 in Los Angeles was first broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, of course, it just, it grew. But you did not have that as a distraction either from your schooling or from all of the other hobbies, et cetera, that you might have had.
Mm-hmm. But for the last 20 years, certainly you've been involved in this a nonprofit foundation that is helping at least provide some of those programs that, were so much present for earlier generations.
Yeah, we everything we provide is really supplementary to a point. And what I like to see happen is like on this music program, we have seen other groups in the community come in and cause some the program to be funded. So we may have been the originator of it, but we're just doing some of the funding now, not all of it.
So what you're saying is that your group came and started funding some of the programs, and then other groups saw that it was possible to do that, and they sort of picked up the charge because they could see how you'd done it, and they came in and did something similar.
Exactly, and it all works together. We don't play the game of this is our program and we will do it our way, and we don't want you out there raising money in competition with us, that kind of thing. Life's too short for that kind of an attitude.
Uh-huh. So is there a lot of cooperation between groups then?
Oh, not that much, but we talk and things get done. And the other thing is going back to these alumni, they have a website that comprises probably 50 different pages that are edited by people that have graduated as early as 1948 and then forward. And they use those pages to rally people to some of their causes, and just providing a formal dress for the new choir.
Mm-hmm.
That was a money-raising effort off the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And providing money for the band, and et cetera.
So you can tell that there's sort of a pattern, and that the groups tend to work inside the pattern. And one of the first things that they identify a constituency, a group of people as a community that they can do outreach to. And they use the internet as one of their tools.
Yeah, and really, I must tell you that the originally this website was just a means of communicating with alumni. And there was no thought that it would be used for raising funds for whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that has just evolved over the last, probably 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I had one fellow who was selling a property and had an enormous amount of daffodils planted, and he knew that they were going to all be dug up. So it was, you give $100 for the band uniforms or whatever the program was, and you get a write-off for that, and I'll send you a whole package of daffodil bulbs from my property. And it's amazing. People responded to that.
Mm-hmm. So you did a lot of innovation in terms of fundraising, and people looked around at what they had, and they used the resources that they had available.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, it's all, let your imagination run. And I think far too frequently, people will think that, well, we could do it this way. In other words, they have a proposal in mind, and then they start with the what-if negatives, and what if this doesn't happen, and what if this doesn't happen, and they sell themselves on not doing what it is they were going to propose. And I've seen that too frequently, and it's it's a terrible mental attitude to have, but it's really not uncommon.
Uh-huh. So one of the things you try to do is help people break past that?
So well,
you've been doing this for 20 years. You must have a lot of experience in that.
I think that we take it upon ourselves to act in a certain way, and it becomes, I can't see the long-term results of this, this is what I'd like to see happen, but let's try this on a short-term basis and see what develops, because it comes down to you cannot wait until you have all the information about something before you act on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the real world.
Right. That's certainly
people,
not the business world.
Not at all. And people too frequently think that they have to do that. You and I had a discussion about that with some of my old objectivist friends.
But right.
I don't think we go into that now unless you want to.
We can go into anything we want to. Oh. Perfectly relevant.
Well, suffice it to say that that's people that are just trying to be super rational and have really, I think, put the lid on their intuition tend to be the people that will not take action until they, quote-unquote, have all of the information necessary. And the information is just never available.
Mm-hmm.
So many of these friends of mine never really took any action as far as their careers were concerned or projects they wanted to launch or whatever.
And, of course, what that actually, there are people in the world that are very much like that, and we usually call them bureaucrats.
Yep, that's
what they become. They have a very bureaucrat. They're not entrepreneurs.
Yeah, yeah. I think that these people that actually aren't employed as bureaucrats, but that think that way, you don't want them to have positions of power and guidance in these volunteer organizations.
Mm-hmm.
If you do, nothing will get done.
And so is that one of the things you avoid?
Yes, and I'll tell you, the superintendent of schools that came up with the idea to do this foundation, he actually was a graduate of a local high school, Don Montgomery, and he's since passed away, but Don told us when we were founding this foundation, he says, I want you to know that we tried to do this 3 or 4 years ago, and we had a foundation going, but we had too many of the bureaucracy from the district, school board members, district office people, etc., that all had a similar mindset, and they never could get anything done because they could never really arrive at a decision and say, yes, let's go ahead with this.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, fair warning. So we have been very careful about how many of the bureaucratic side we have on our board. And as a matter of fact, we don't. They're invited guests at our meetings, and we seek input and guidance from them, but we don't have them spearheading projects usually.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's now been enough study done of personality types and different ways that people actually think, so that we know that there are different kinds of people in the world.
Oh, definitely.
And, of course, that's not something that people realize when they started to put together even the entire pattern for centralized government. It just simply wasn't on the radar screen.
Yeah, that's very true. I know from my own experience in the securities brokerage industry why the guys that generally succeeded as stockbrokers were intelligent, they were result-oriented, they were able to deal and mingle with people on a basis of equality rather than superiority one side to the other. And they were the ones that lasted in the business. They benefited, their clients benefited, and the ones that couldn't do that didn't last long in the business.
Would you say that the difference was that they needed more structure? That they couldn't be comfortable creating their own structure?
I think that's true of some people, but I've found that people, if you were to give them more structure, they're still not willing to really do any more than when they had less structure. It just seems to be the nature of the beast. And it's not that you can't use them, you just can't give them positions of creativity and authority.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always been very odd. I mean, you'll see educational specialties in areas that are very clearly creative, and people will go into those arenas and they will learn about everything else that everybody else ever did, and they'll never create anything themselves, but they can have a PhD in it.
Yes, yes.
And that's always struck me as one of the funniest things I could possibly imagine.
It is, and it's I don't think it's tragic, but it's just, you say, my goodness, all of that intellectual capacity going to gather all that knowledge, and for what use?
Mm-hmm.
So they can tell others about it, but encourage them to act on it.
So the first resource that you have is coming up with a database of people who are interested, and that's really a social connection.
Yeah, and that's really a rather informal thing. We had, like going back to the start of this education foundation, why the superintendent who started it had a list of people that he would like to be in on the founding, and had went so far as to invite others, and some said, yeah, I want to be in on it, and some said, no, I don't, and I don't have the time or whatever. And once we're started, why, I can tell you that of the 30 or so people that were in it at the beginning, there probably are four or five of us remaining.
Mm-hmm.
And you might question our sanity and good judgment for staying that long. And it's not that these people didn't work out or anything. They were just, well, I've given enough to the community through this Ed Foundation. Now we're going to move on and do other things. And so many of them have done that. Yet they're available to you many times without asking. As an example, tragically last year, just about this time, a young Marine graduate of the high school, he'd graduated in 2004, was killed on his third day in Iraq.
Oh.
And, you know, there's an outpouring of sympathy, et cetera, but what was needed also was helping the family at that time, and also we decided we'd create a scholarship in his name.
Mm-hmm.
And the outpouring for that was not great, but sufficient. And one woman who had served on our board before sent us a check, and it was matched by her employer, that really will probably fund half the scholarship for as long as she continues to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get others on board and want to be part of it. And some of them old veterans from years ago, and some of them younger people.
So you get a whole range.
Exactly.
Of people who are involved. Do the people who fund particular scholarships come together and, you know, get to know each other then differently?
Oh yes, definitely. The foundation does not like to play the holier than thou. We're collecting this money, and therefore only we can decide who will receive it. We take and form committees of the people who have raised the money, be they a particular class or, in the case of this young Marine, just a group, and they decide. They interview the applicants, and they decide who will receive the funds. And it's very, they love it. You know, they really like what they're doing.
So what you're really talking about is always keeping the action and the control local. The people
yep.
who are giving the money come on board, not just to give the money, but to become proactively part of the program and the decision making.
Yes.
And that works.
it does work in what we do too periodically. It's not a formal program by any stretch of the imagination, but we will go and ask people from a given class or a given part of the community, you'd fit in doing this. Would you care to join us for the next year or two in doing this? And, they do or they don't. But you have to ask. So many times people don't necessarily seek you out.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, of course. Do you have how do you keep people on board? Is that simply because people become invested emotionally and socially?
I think that's part of it. They like the camaraderie of the board meetings when it comes to these committees that select the scholarship winners. There's a camaraderie there. They may stay in touch with one another over the year between formal face-to-face meetings when they interview these students. And occasionally something more formal comes of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back to this this website and the alumni. I can't tell you the number of them who have lost spouses who wind up remarrying people from this group coalesced around a particular class that they're from.
So it sort of becomes a community.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
A very much extended community with very tight social bonds.
Yeah, and they will tell you, these who have remarried, we share a very similar background and values, not, rigidly so, but we do, so it's much easier to find out, gee, do I really want to spend the remainder of my life with this person or not?
Yes. So there is a very strong social component, and the money that is donated, it goes specifically to scholarships then for specific students?
Yes, as far as the scholarship side is concerned, some of the other things that the foundation has done let me backtrack for a moment. We also had a goal for the various classes that they should, if they wanted to, attempt to raise sufficient money so that the scholarship at a particular level could be given in perpetuity,
mm-hmm.
which means that obviously they wouldn't be around to award it forever and ever, but as long as they could have a group, they could do it, and then it would pass to others.
Mm-hmm.
And we're beginning to have that happen, where one class has raised enough, say, to fund a $2,000 or $3,000 scholarship, and if put out just at normal SNL rates, why it'll fund it in perpetuity, if not be able to throw off a little bit more,
mm-hmm.
and make a larger one as time goes by.
Mm-hmm. And how do they make the decision who'll take over for them?
Do they sort of assign
it to a younger class? Or?
I think that's what it will happen. We're just beginning to experience this. We haven't had any committee fall by the wayside yet. Well, maybe that's not a good expression, but we haven't had any committee that's had to be replaced because of age or loss.
Mm-hmm.
But that will happen, and you have to prepare for it. And we think that the younger classes will do it, and perhaps we'll have others from the community in general do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it is benefiting the community per se, as opposed just to the very large alumni community that we have.
Yeah, but you have a very large self-conscious alumni community that you've helped to create.
Yes, I can't take any real credit for helping to create it, but they will have reunions, and then when the internet raised its head, why one of the older fellows said, hey, we can do a website and there were several that were very computer savvy and had it set up and funded it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been going on now for probably 6 or 7 years.
One of the things that occurs to me is that you seems like you're doing networking along the sort of timeline too, because here you have kids who are receiving the scholarships. And you've been doing it for 20 years. Have you noticed that the kids who receive it have actually come back and become part of that community themselves?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a little early to tell because we started doing the scholarships really one class about 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and other classes have fallen in within the last 4 or 5 years. We've really made that as a... an outreach and a project to get as many involved as we can. As far as the students coming back into the community and being involved in the community, they're not there yet. A lot of them don't come back to Monrovia. A lot of them go to New York or stay at Berkeley or wherever. Some of them, once you've given them their scholarship, you don't hear from them again. And others you do with a certain frequency.
Mm-hmm.
One of the scholarship committee members, a dentist, became a mentor to another young man who wanted to be a reconstructive dental surgeon. And so those kind of relationships developed too. And this young man is probably just going to be finishing his university work before he begins the dental school. He'll probably finish it, I think, this year.
Mm-hmm.
And these things happen. It's not he's not the only one that has made that tie with a member of the alumni group.
So people tie into the group in many different ways. And you're working to tie people in, cross generational lines.
Yep, there certainly are. And the other projects that the foundation does, we always tell people, you want to come on our board, you ought to have an idea that we're not currently funding, doing, et cetera, that you'd like to spearhead.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had. A program called a Teach Your Baby to Read, and it was rather interesting. Some of the elementary teachers poo-pooed it, and even went so far as to say, "Why, you're just making our jobs difficult if you're sending us children that are reading at second or third grade level when they're just coming into kindergarten." Gee, you should have it so good. But we were doing this. Through the public library,
uh-huh.
and it was a very, for my money, it was probably the most cost-effective thing that we could have been doing. You'd have mothers and sometimes fathers or sometimes couples come who had children as young as infants, and this program has been around for 45 years or more. Someone named Glenn Doman out of a foundation in I think upstate New York developed it, and it involves a lot of interaction between the mother or the father and the very young child, and it takes into consideration the cognitive abilities and the development that's going on of this infant or young child. And we discovered it about 40 years ago, or probably a little more than that. And my daughter was already about 4 and a half, and she was almost ready to read. And it helped her, and then we taught my her sister, who was 2 years younger,
mm-hmm.
and they taught their brother, who was 3 years younger than that. So everybody that started school went as a reader with a love of books and an innate love of learning.
That's amazing. So what you do is you encourage people to try new programs so that there's definitely a proactive attitude toward innovation.
Yes, and yet, you know, when you think about it, like this program is 50 years old now, but I got a letter from a woman who had participated in it several years ago, and when her daughter was very young, and last year she wrote, she said, "You should be interested in knowing that we'll call her daughter Yvonne. Yvonne started kindergarten last year, and I had a call about a month later from her teacher wanting me to come and talk to the principal about her. And they just explained that she was reading at about second grade level, and at the very least they'd like her to be in first grade, which she was. So, you know, for whatever people think about skipping grades, why this child skipped, and the mother was very pleased.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see how the child turns out. Perhaps she'll be another Bonnie looking for Clyde. I don't know. I don't think reading would cause her to do that. But
Bovia has an extremely proactive community in terms of keeping people involved in the community and as part, you know, part of the life of the community.
Yes. There's, you know, a lot of groups out there doing not exactly what we do, but working to help the schools do their job better, to help the teachers. We do a grants program, and basically it's you write us up a grant request, it's all of 2 pages, and can be up to $1,000, and tell us what you want to do for you know, with the money, and what do you think the outcomes will be, and then we have a committee of our board members who review all of this and make grants every year.
Mm-hmm.
And all the teachers have to do is provide you with receipts and some input as to whether their idea worked or not.
That's amazing.
Fantastic
thing.
It's been very well received, and the one thing that we have stayed away from is funding field trips, which can be very expensive. And are sort of one-shot deals, and also funding computer equipment.
Mm-hmm.
We just have said, okay, don't tell me that you want a PowerPoint system, because, you know, I don't really think that it's the great teaching tool that some people might think, and if Bill Gates is listening, why, he may take action.
That's fine. We can just go take action, right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, you have a tremendous body of you know, of wisdom and knowledge that the Monrovia and you have put together through the foundation. And if other people wanted to call and get your advice to do similar things, would you be willing to do that?
Oh, sure. We'd be willing to talk with them. I think initially you might just give my email address, and we can communicate by email, and if we need to, you know, talk personally, why, then we can do it by phone.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe perhaps if they're nearby, we can meet.
That would be fantastic, because there's so many communities that are struggling now with some of these issues. Things are unfunded, and they don't have the resource, but you can see that they could create it. It's a matter of the will and the desire to make their community different.
Yes. Very definitely, and people all too frequently think that the money's not there, and you know, my rather flip response to some of them is, well, let's see, you could hawk the spinner hubcaps on your SUV for probably $3,000. There's a start.
That's a good point.
And you know, what I'm just saying is that if you go out and try to involve everybody, you can expect to have, given if you have reasonably good leadership, you can expect to have a long run at this and have a good time doing it.
Well, that's obvious, too, because obviously it's become a part of your life and a part of the life of the community.
Yes, it has. Yeah, and I'm, you know, I'm pleased to be part of it, very definitely.
That's a wonderful thing. Well, you know, Bruce, thank you so much for being with us today and for telling us about something that really is an example for people all over the country.
Well, it's also an just example of how high-tech we are, because I'm sitting in my car doing this interview from my cell phone, and, you know, 20 years ago, that wouldn't have been possible.
That's right. So much more is possible today if it's properly used.
You got it.
Okay, you take care. You have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you for the invite. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. And that's our show for today, Friday, January 19th, 2007. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find ways to bring government into alignment with the way we know we should be treating each other, personally, in business, and in every other point of our lives. Freedom and doing the right thing matters in all points of those lives. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.